Hey, it's Daryl Etherington. I'm here with Anthony Ha. Hello, Anthony.
Hello, Daryl.
And we're bringing you original content, not the actual, well, yes, the actual original content and the podcast original content from TechCrunch, where we talk about everything streaming that is made for digital services and tech stuff, right? That's basically how it goes.
That I'm not sure if that's the tagline we're going with, but I think that pretty much encapsulates
rolls
it,
off
yes.
the tongue. It's like,
yeah,
it's designed
absolutely
for marketing copy, right? Pretty cool.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to talk about. So let's get into some news. We got loads of news. It seems like, I mean, maybe it's just because I'm paying attention now, but there's tons going on.
Not just posting the trailers and then like getting back to writing about cars and phones.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like the low hanging fruit of like, but I'm still doing that. I'm still doing the low hanging fruit. Can't stop me. Won't stop.
Never. We should say before we, just for people who don't know, this episode is we're going to do the news roundup, and then we're going to do talk about the second half of The Defenders. So that's what we're going to cover in this episode.
I think it's probably worth even reiterating in more detail our format just so people know, because I think some people are hesitating to go and listen because of spoilers, but we can assure you there will be no spoilers in the first half of the episode. So that's a big, long chunk. And we'll alert you as soon as there are going to be spoilers with a very clear break and disclaimer so you can stop it and then, you know, keep it in your podcast player for when you do watch that thing. I did get an email today about somebody who went out, watched Okja, and then came back and listened to the remainder of the podcast. So that was pretty cool.
And perfect. That's what we like to hear.
Yeah, it's a good way to do it. So do it that way. Okay, so news. Getting right to it.
Starting with Snapchat doing scripted content by the end of the year.
Yes. And so Snapchat has shows. They've done a lot with shows, and they've worked a lot with partners and networks and stuff to do kind of companion content, mostly for reality shows and also unscripted. And now they're going to do a sort of a larger scripted push. But it's not their first scripted push. Do you know about their first scripted push, Anthony?
I do, but only because I have the article open in front of me. There was a show called Literally Can't Even, and I had no idea that existed until 2 minutes ago.
I think that Snapchat would like that to be the case for everyone. I think they want no one to remember that this existed because it wasn't bad. I think universally it was sort of panned and regarded as bad. Now, I don't know if that's how audiences actually received it, except for the fact that it like went away, it died. Because Snapchat has like a sort of a thing where everybody says their stuff is bad, their user experience or their app, and then people still like it. The teens eat it up. But this time, I don't know if that happened. You never saw it, right?
I never saw it. I mean, I think, you know, not to harp on this, but I mean, I do think that you and I as dudes who are creeping into our mid-30s, probably not quite the target demographic for this. We're probably a little bit
don't
on the old side.
Our secrets.
But I think that is possibly part of it, but I don't think it just got a lot of attention either. I mean, the other thing about Snapchat is I mean, I find, you know, I definitely use it, but like I have to force myself to use it because I just don't want to be completely left behind.
Yeah.
But one of the things that as far as I can tell it's really bad at is it's not good at helping you find, you know, like an archive of content. It can be like, hey, here is a new thing from, you know, one of our media partners that will disappear, you know, shortly, but it's not great for, hey, here are 10 episodes of something that you might want to watch.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's not like it doesn't have a TV guide, basically, or like even just a sort of a navigable menu of items and selections the way that like Netflix does, right? I'm actually looking right now because I haven't in a while to see like how do you find the stuff? And you just
the new name of this podcast is Old Men Talk About Snapchat.
Where are the things in the doodad? Yeah, okay. So you scroll over to your list of stories or whatever, then you scroll down and shows are underneath there, right? So it's not unreasonable. Like they're there, fairly discoverable. Mine is only showing four. I think maybe is that it? Maybe in terms of expiry and currency, that's all there is available right now. But And looking at them, they're all like kind of reality shows or like news or news magazine type shows, which seem to be the big popular push right now. So we don't know much about these original content that's coming later yet, the scripted content. But I think, I mean, there's potential there, right? There's lots of potential with this sort of micro fiction opportunity. You've written about Wattpad before, right, Anthony?
I have. Yeah. Wattpad. And then also, gosh, I'm totally blanking on the name, Hooked.
Yes.
Which is like a texting app. A text fiction app. But yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of interesting things people can do with these sort of shorter videos. I mean, I think it can also risk getting very gimmicky and silly, and especially when you're doing something for mobile that is, you know, the idea of, you know, that people might just be reading or watching it with the sound turned off, I find very dispiriting.
But yeah, that's true. It's tricky. It's like, I think that's the majority of consumption, I would imagine, is something like that, right? And I mean, you see it in like just sort of social videos where people have like turn the sound on, like it'll actually have like a sign in the thing or a caption.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you have to work around that, but that's awkward.
Yeah, it's the whole thing is very. I don't know. I mean, I think there's definitely some interesting stuff, and I mean, you look at like. I think some people have done interesting things on Instagram where, you know, they mix photos and videos, and the photos themselves are sort of like the discovery, like the whole like profile page can become like a discovery mechanism for finding interesting videos. I think, so what I was talking about earlier in terms of the interface with Snapchat was more like, you know, that there's a show section, but it's really for helping you find new stuff. And it doesn't have that sort of like archive function in the same way. And so I think like, it just seems like, the way content works in Snapchat right now is you just sort of are like, hey, here's some cool new stuff. And then in the same way that the messages are ephemeral, in a way the content is sort of ephemeral too, which makes me wonder, you know, how that transfers to scripted content, where I think there's usually a little bit more of an expectation that stuff is going to stick around for a while.
Yeah. And that's actually perfect for news, right? Like that's why that makes such good sense as like a initial partner, news and sports, like anything live. Is already ephemeral by nature, so it's fine to not have it like archived.
I mean, I definitely think that, you know, some of the blog posts I wrote 5-10 years ago should be read forever, but I accept that the rest of the world doesn't agree
on this. Do you think that?
No, I really don't. I mean, there's a handful of things that I'm still happy with, but it's not like I don't actually expect that anyone would be reading it. No.
Sure, yeah. I think if my archive were scoured from the earth, it would be no worse.
I think definitely the best thing is like, you know, the music reviews that I wrote for like the college newspaper. Those are gone from the internet, and I'm really happy about that.
So that's some of the stuff. Actually, yeah. So the things that I regret that are not available on the internet anymore are my own original content, like the web comics that I used to write and draw and host on GeoCities. So that's
you'll just have to make some new ones and then post them on TechCrunch.
Yeah, because I would trade my entire like 10,000 post archive for just a couple of those sweet, sweet comics. They were hilarious.
Wait, don't post them on TechCrunch though, because then Oath owns them.
Oh yeah, that's true. I don't want to give them to Uncle Tim Armstrong.
No, no, sir. well, so I think we also wanted to talk about some of the content announcements from Netflix, right?
Yes, because there was a lot. There's always a lot now. But there was some that I'm personally super excited about. There were some that look really interesting. There are some that are a little bit like, okay, let's see what you do with this. So it covers the range.
Why don't you classify them for us?
Okay. I wanted to let people kind of figure it out on their own, but no, let's let's do it by category. So the ones I guess I'm personally super excited about, there's the Stranger Things season 3. I don't think there's many people who aren't excited about that, judging by the general response that we get at TechCrunch to kind of Stranger Things related content. People seem to love that. So and I love that show. And I have you seen any really negative critiques or?
I think there are some people, I don't think anyone hates it, but there are people who think it's a bit overrated. To be completely honest, I mean, I'm
like
not anti Stranger Things, but I've definitely, I came to it fairly late and watched it maybe a month ago, and I didn't love it. I thought it was fine. It was good. I enjoyed it.
Now, is that because you just want to be really cool and you are doing a contrarian sort of a hipster response, or was it because you genuinely had issues with it?
I didn't have issues with it. It was more that I think because it had been built up as this thing, and I think it's a show that just, I think it's really great for binging. It's really, like, you never want to stop. But, like, I think once it's over, nothing really stuck with me. I was just kind of like, oh, that was fun. You know, that was fine.
Yeah.
Sure. What's next? Nothing. Yeah. I wasn't, like, terrified or moved by it particularly. I think a couple of the early episodes I think may have, like, scared me. But after that, I wasn't even particularly scared. I didn't even think, like, the monster was that interesting.
So this might get into why I like it so much. I actually will copy that. I don't think the monster was super interesting or memorable itself. But I also, I don't like scary things that much, especially right. if they're very effectively scary. And I liked this weirdo. But I love watching, like, you know, just like Discovery show is about Sasquatch or some crap like that. So this was sort of a mix for me that was like comfortably there. Like, it was unnerving and creepy and mysterious, but like not in the terrifying way. And then it was also sort of fun and, you know, 80s buddy adventure vibe that I liked too. So I think that's why it hit the perfect balance for me, and for the same reason that you weren't crazy about it.
Yeah, that's fair. But I think the other thing that's interesting about this announcement was also just that they're announcing season 3 before season 2 has even come out, mm-hmm. which I guess is, I mean, both a sign of confidence and also maybe giving the creators, you know, some more runway so they can say, like, okay, we know that we don't have to wrap everything up with season 2. And so we can, you know, that we're going to get more, you know, more seasons. And so that we can start planning ahead, you know, a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a rare sort of thing to get as a showrunner or as a creator, is this like certain knowledge that you're going to go this long. Right. I think we were talking about offline. We were talking about The Leftovers a bit, because I think we both love The Leftovers. Mm-hmm. And you know, that was kind of a thing there, right? Like, every season was sort of up in the air. It has, I think that part of its sort of like appeal is that it felt a bit improvisational, but, you know, maybe they could have done something different if they had felt like, and again, I loved it. I thought it was great. But if they knew, like, we have a 4-season arc and let's like tell a story end to end within that, who knows how it would have been different. And that sounds like what they've got at Stranger Things. Because they said 3 confirmed and 4 likely.
Yeah, and I think that they probably want to wrap it up after 4, maybe 5. But and I will say, one of the things I really liked about it, though, actually, was the fact that in the same way, I think similar to probably like a horror movie of the 80s, there were certainly things that you could see setting up future storylines, but that the first season was very self-contained. It wasn't that kind of the kind of show where you watch the first season and then it ends on this giant cliffhanger and none of your questions have been answered, and they're like, come back in, you know, 3 months, or come back in a year.
Right.
But it felt like a very satisfying experience on its own. And so I hope that as they do future seasons, even if obviously it may become a little bit more interconnected and a little bit more sprawling, they still try to deliver a satisfying experience with each season.
Yeah, and I think they will. I think so. The way that it was the Duffer Brothers, and the one that was interviewed in the original article where all this information came from, which is from Vulture, and we'll include it in the show notes, was like he characterized them. He said he didn't want to think of them as sort of seasons of a television show, but more of as movies and their sequels. So I think that leads me to believe that they will treat it exactly the way you say.
Right.
I hope so. Anyway, if the next one ends up a big cliffhanger, that'll be weird. He was also talking about the challenge of, like, it's such a strange balance to strike, because you're like, you're telling this in a way very kind of like homey story about like a small community, but then you also have to ramp up the stakes. Like, that's just the nature of telling a sort of a horror type or even a sci-fi, you know, tale like that. So they're trying to figure out, like, how can we do that while keeping things not believable, because it's already, you know, stretching the limits of belief, but like something you'll go along with and follow, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting. I mean, thinking about it, like one of the shows that I think about in terms of that kind of structure is also Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which was a show where that they talk about, which is a little bit weird to talk about this week because of some of the news around the creator, Joss Whedon.
But what happened?
His wife, his ex-wife wrote an article. He got separated and then divorced like in the last few years, but all of this has been secret until now. And it basically just came out, and his wife wrote this article about how he lied to her for the course of their 15-year marriage.
Whoa.
And was cheating on her the whole time, and how that sort of like undermines his credibility as a feminist, and that she has post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of like their how the marriage came apart. So, a lot of people are sort of feeling conflicted about being Joss Whedon fans right now.
Yeah. I had no idea that any of that happened.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We'll put that in the show notes, too. Which, I mean, I think, I mean, and maybe that, you know, this is, that. I mean, obviously one of the things that anyone who's sort of a fan of television or films or books or movies, I mean, that you inevitably sort of have to wrestle with is sort of liking things who are created by people who are not necessarily that great. And we should say in the Joss Whedon case, I mean, he essentially declined to comment and said, like, you know, because this is about stuff that affects our family, I'm not going to comment on this,
right.
Which, although it was also one of those not comments where there was like a, you know, several sentences. And you're like, well, you basically just commented. You're just not addressing any of the specific issues.
Yeah.
But like, you know, that there's a certain moment of where you say like, well, what am I willing to still get excited about, even if I know that the people who made this are not necessarily that great. I mean,
yeah.
One of my favorite, you know, probably my favorite television show of all time is Star Trek. And Gene Roddenberry, by all accounts, was a pretty great guy in some ways, but around women was kind of a sleazebag. And so, wow, yeah, now I'm going to get a lot of angry emails. But I mean, if you read any of the behind the scenes stuff about Star Trek, I mean, I don't think that that's actually particularly controversial.
Right.
And so, you know, that you sort of have to like make peace with these two things in your head of like, well, I like the thing, not necessarily crazy about the person, you know, behind the thing.
Right. It's the classic debate that's, you know,
right.
I went to liberal arts, you know, higher education, and that was always the thing too.
Right.
Author work.
Death of the author.
Yeah. 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 So,
yeah, so I mean, part of the reason I brought that up before, getting to explain the fun of the Joss Whedon drama this week was just Buffy the Vampire Slayer was a show where I think they've talked about the idea that every season they said, okay, this could be our last season. Let's make this season as if the season finale could be the series finale, which in a lot of ways I respect. But then they would have to come back at the beginning of every year and say, oh shit, what the hell are we going to do this year to top what we did last year and make it seem even bigger and more dramatic? And I think that's true of any sort of show, but I think a sort of supernatural adventure / horror show like Stranger Things or Buffy, I think has to wrestle with that even more.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I think, yeah, more so, maybe more so too, even when you're dealing with this kind of like, oh, it's a bunch of kids and they're having a fun time bonding and being buddies or whatever, right? Like it's tricky keeping that balance where you're like still keeping them like children and growing up and having their formative years and then like also fighting super monsters that they have no business fighting or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. That it starts, I guess, like if they get that. If one time they get pulled into fighting, you know, these super monsters just because of circumstance, that makes sense. And even, I think, you know, they had to sort of, you know, twist things around. Or like, you know, the plot had to sort of jump through some hoops to make it so that the kids could stay involved in the plot, in the story as more and more adults got involved. Because you would think naturally, normally what you would do as soon as you realize there are kids trying to hunt this monster, you'd be like, get the hell out of here, kids. We're going to deal with this. And so I think for the kids to stay involved in the plot, as the story unfolds, I think will be an interesting challenge for them, and not for them to make it seem ridiculous that their parents are letting them do this and not being like, what is wrong with you?
Yeah. Yeah. I think they stand a pretty good chance, because as long as they keep it, you know, they have leeway, they have freedom to do it. Audiences are going to trust them to do stuff and like keep it kind of light and irreverent, and they'll follow them. I think they can test the limits of credulity for quite a bit more. So I'm excited about it. I think it's going to be good.
Yeah. All right. So that's one of the ones that you're super excited about. What else we got?
Do you want to keep on excited things, or
you tell me? We could do one of the ones you're less excited about.
Okay, let's do one that I'm not less. This is just one where I'm like, okay, I don't know how to feel about this yet, but it's the Lady Gaga documentary that they've just announced
called Lady Gaga 5'2".
5'2". Yes, and it's emotional, apparently.
Which, as somebody who's 5'4", that makes me feel really good. That it's, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're rounding up, I'm 5'4".
Okay.
Not to dwell on it. But yeah, it seems like it's supposed to deal with some, I mean, there's going to be some, you know, performance footage, but there's also going to be some personal stuff as well.
Right. Yeah, there's a, what is it? She cries, I'm alone, is one thing I saw as a headline. Lady Gaga cries, I'm alone, in new documentary. Here's a quote from her, from a scene in this documentary. I'm alone every night, and all these people will leave, right? They will leave, and I'll be alone. And I go from everyone touching me all day and talking at me all day to total silence. Wow, okay.
That's my life too, yeah.
Yeah, it's tough. Yeah, same. It me.
So, I mean, I think like it also speaks to, I mean, that I think that Lady Gaga, like 5 years ago, I think like Lady Gaga was the most interesting like musician around.
Yes.
And that she was this, I mean, and even less, I mean, I think her music was good, but that she was interesting just as this performer, as, you know, the sort of someone who created these sort of full package of like the album, the video, and all the, and you know, the concert, and all these different things that were sort of around these like themes, and were almost sort of like these performance art pieces.
Yeah. And who it's like, well, at least for me, like seemingly come out of nowhere, but then you realize, like, as you looked more into it, her career, she had been like behind this very influential behind the scenes, like as a songwriter and stuff for some of the larger pop stars,
right,
of her time. And then all of a sudden was like, yeah, like so carefully orchestrating the whole package, right, with the experience all the way to the album and everything else, like you said.
So in that sense, like the idea of like a documentary about her seems really interesting, but at the same time, there's also, I guess you worry that there's sort of sometimes this like manufactured drama, or very kind of formulaic drama. I don't want to say manufactured, because I don't want to say that whatever pain or issues she's dealing with in the course of the documentary aren't real,
right,
but just in the sense that whether or not like a behind the scenes documentary can really make you like feel that and explore that, or if it's just going to be kind of like a drag or feel kind of formulaic, I don't know. I mean,
yeah, for artists, that kind of experience has been heavily commoditized, right? Like that's exactly what Behind the Music was basically that, in a kind of rote way. That maybe, I guess, has sort of hardened us against the experience, right? Like we're kind of like, it sounded like when you were talking about it just there, that was the sort of thing you're thinking of, right? Like it's,
yeah,
like, and I've heard this before because of stuff like that.
Yeah, that like I've heard, you know, and I mean, it's also the thing that people talk about, I think, with popular artists in general, but particularly with musicians, where this can also creep into their music, is the thing of like, woe is me, I'm the sad rock star.
Right.
Which is,
it's hard to relate
hand,
to as a non-rock,
yeah,
star.
Is again, not to say that pain isn't real, but at the same time, it's not like an interesting, most of the time, it's not like an interesting pain. It's not a relatable pain. It's just like, oh, okay, yeah, I guess it must really suck to have these giant audiences applauding for you and then disappearing.
Yeah. And I think also like adding to that effect is like, like she also tweeted out the news of it, right? But she said,
right,
I'm known for being larger than life, but really I'm just .. #Gaga 5'2". Like, That's a little bit much. And then you know, she has the cover art for it and everything, which is good. Like, it's not like she's working with a creator, like an actual documentarian who has made this. So hopefully that means it's not just like a strictly promotional effort, but it's weird to see someone so heavily push their sort of own life story like that. Maybe that's unfitting with her character, like her performative self, right?
Yeah, I mean, it seems, I mean, it's funny because this is also the same week we've had this, you know, very orchestrated social media announcement about Taylor Swift's new album. And in some ways, she's announcing the documentary the same way she would be announcing a new album.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. That's very accurate. Yeah, the Taylor Swift stuff was nuts too. I don't even know if we want to talk about, is that too much of a sidetrack here?
I mean, it's up to you.
I don't know. She wiped all of her social media accounts. And that
we
was
did.
Like,
I mean, I think one sort of funny behind the scenes thing is we can say is definitely, I think within TechCrunch, we were definitely looking at these tweets that were like, oh my God, Taylor Swift got hacked. And we're like, oh my, should we write about Taylor Swift getting hacked? And then we sort of realized, oh, this is probably just a promotional thing. Let's hold off.
Yeah, the back channel evolution of it was pretty funny to watch, the beat by beat. And then also, there was a lot of interest, right? That was also, I think, so, like, it was cool how, it was cool and really thought-provoking how the way that she managed to drive so much interest in this, like, new album and whatever was coming next was by, like, introducing an absence. Like, she was like, oh, no, I just stripped all my accounts of everything. And that was what, that was far more effective than anything she could have done in terms of, like, just teasing something, you know, in her existing feed or without doing anything to her past content.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, and again, maybe the Lady Gaga thing is a good contrast to that, where it's somebody who I think, you know, has a very active social media presence, but didn't necessarily do anything dramatic, just as like, hey, here's a few, you know, melodramatic tweets about this thing, versus somebody who this much more aggressive, you know, much more noticeable, just stripping away of the entire history.
Yeah.
Which, I, by the way, I just find crazy. The idea of like all of someone's tweets disappearing. That, you know, I think some people I know use these like apps that that just like automatically delete your tweets like 2 weeks after you've posted them, which I just find completely insane and like really antithetical to a lot of the ways that I think about social media as sort of
it makes
this
me
weird
nervous
record.
To think about. I feel like I get kind of anxious thinking about it, about all that just being gone. Even though I don't think I've created anything particularly memorable, useful, you know, like across Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter or anything, but I still am like, oh man, imagine if it was just all deleted one day. It makes
it's crazy to think about.
Yeah.
And all of Taylor's amazing tweets. I mean, I don't remember any of her tweets, so.
Oh, they were so good.
I bet, yeah.
Like her complete absence of political expression of opinion. That's the one. Somebody tweeted, like, do you think that she'll comment on the Trump presidency in the upcoming album? And it's like, no, she will not.
Right. And I wouldn't want her to. And I mean, I think, like, if Taylor Swift wanted to tweet, you know, once in a while that, like, Donald Trump was a garbage person because he's a garbage person and a garbage president. This podcast is going great, making friends and influencing people. But like that would be fine. But like I don't want like a protest song from Taylor Swift. That doesn't seem interesting to me.
Right? No. Yeah, but some posts acknowledging the garbageness of Trump and his presidency would be appreciated.
Right. A tweet that goes up and disappears. You know.
Yeah, yeah.
Later.
She deletes it and puts up snake pictures or whatever.
Snakes.
So
let's get it back on track.
Yeah,
Netflix.
way away from Gaga there, but I mean I'll probably watch it because I'm intrigued by it. Like they've done enough to make it seem like at the very least it'll be some kind of a spectacle that I find interesting, so I think I'm gonna check it out.
Yeah, and I mean I think the documentaries, I don't think those are like the marquee, you know, put on a giant billboard kind of things for Netflix, but I think they've done a bunch of like interesting like documentaries and documentary series, so the fact, you know, it's also interesting that, you know, the fact that it's a Netflix documentary doesn't seem weird now. You're just like, oh, sure, yeah, why not?
Yeah, they seem to do a lot of that. So I think, and I think they've done pretty well with it so far. And I hope they continue to do them. I again, like, reserving judgment on this individual one, but in general. And it seems like they do a lot of that because it's also sort of like lower hanging fruit too, right? Like it's a bit easier to put together a documentary versus a feature film or other things like that. So in terms of return for their investment,
right,
it's probably a really good deal.
It's lower cost. I think also like filmmakers on the documentary side are more used to the idea of their movies just being watched on TV anyway. And the idea of like not being in a theater. I mean, most documentaries don't make it into theaters anyway. So it doesn't seem strange.
Good point. Yeah. Yeah. So that one was in the weird category for me. But how do you feel about it? Are you excited about it?
See, I think when I just saw the headline Lady Gaga documentary, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. But like, I think what I would like to see is something closer to like, is a concert film, you know, like just a crazy conceptual like concert film that, you know, might have some behind the scenes stuff, but it's something closer to like Stop Making Sense, the Talking Heads documentary.
Right. And it doesn't sound like it's going to be that.
Yeah. And I think she's in the last few years, she's been kind of less, she's been a little bit more all over the place for me, where she's sometimes interesting and sometimes less so. And so I'll definitely be like, I'm definitely open to it, but I don't know if for sure that I'm going to like it.
Yeah. Yeah, same.
But maybe, I mean, it may be one of those things where actually we watch it and we're like, holy shit, perfect. She had like all these sort of, I mean, I could definitely, she's somebody who I could imagine having like all this sort of like hidden depths that we weren't aware of. And maybe seeing her, you know, in that context would be, you know, it'll really change the way we look at her. Possibly.
Yeah, for sure. And I don't know what the documentarian behind it has done previously either. So that could change, sway my opinion one way or another once I find out. Okay, he had a feature documentary called Me at the Zoo, and I don't know what that is. Oh, he was approached to direct Banksy Does New York, but then he did not direct that.
Wow, when you put it that way.
Oh, wait, no, he did.
Okay.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
What's his name?
His name is, oh yeah, I didn't say that. Chris Mukarbel? I don't know how to say this, but we'll include a link and you can check it out for yourself. Yeah, I'm a little bit more excited about that now, so that could be cool. And yeah, that's September 22nd if people want to.
All right, so that's coming real soon.
Set a date, yeah. A lot of the stuff we're talking about this week is due out in September. So I think one of the other things that I was super excited about was BoJack Horseman is returning. So we knew the date was September 8th already, but we got a trailer for it and it looks good. It looks like more of what I've come to like and expect from BoJack Horseman. So have you seen much of BoJack?
I've seen the first season.
Okay.
And,
but you didn't watch the first season and then go, I'm just going to keep on keeping on.
No, well, because I mean, I think this will become clear as we do this podcast, is I'm definitely somebody, in the same way that I like read a lot of books and don't necessarily commit to the whole, like all the sequels, like I'm definitely somebody with TV who generally watches one season and is like, all right, that's good. And then if I like love it, I'll stick with it. And BoJack, I mean, I liked a lot but I thought it was also just very, you know, that it kind of answered all the questions that I had and resolved itself in a pretty nice way. So I didn't necessarily feel like I had to keep going. I've heard that there were some amazing episodes in you know, seasons 2 and 3, particularly the underwater one, but I just haven't like prioritized getting caught up yet.
Yeah, I think it's a story that really kind of morphs after that first season into something pretty unexpected and like with a lot more emotional depth. Like it had that to begin with, but it really deepens over time, and it's like it remains probably one of my favorite TV shows like in general. And it's weird too because it's like its emotional effect that it leaves you with is not like a thing where you're like, no, I feel good after having watched that. And I think there's less resolution in subsequent seasons than there was in the first, maybe because it was kind of experimental and they weren't sure, like, let's just have this be a contained thing or relatively contained.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's great over time. And it does stuff that is like, kind of like knocks you out emotionally, which is pretty impressive for an animated series with humanoid animal head beings walking around. Right?
Well, I think that to a certain extent, and again, this is just judging from the first season, but I remember especially the second half of the first season just also getting pretty heavy and dark, and the only way, and it seemed like the way they got away with it was because that they could undercut it with jokes and it was with these animals, but like that you could basically have, you know, a character named, a dog named Mr. Peanut Butter, like give a speech about how life is essentially meaningless and you're just trying to distract yourself until you die, and like have that be both really dark but also a good joke. Or to have an episode where BoJack is basically, you know, demanding to know whether or not he's a good person and just begging someone to tell him he's a good person and like having the episode end without an answer. I mean, these are like things that like if you filmed it as a regular drama, like I think you would just be like, this is, I can't handle this.
Yeah.
But the fact that it's done as this cartoon, I think makes it a little bit more bearable.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that it would be impossibly heavy with like real human actors and that kind of dramatization. I think you're right. That's a good point. I never really thought about that, but it makes total sense now. But yeah, I do recommend continue on, and then you gotta binge them all in time for September 8th, which is like next week.
True. I mean, I can watch a season in a day, so it's not too tough, right? Because it's like 30. True. It's like what, 13 episodes? No, not even 13 per season, is it?
It's like 12, maybe? I can't remember.
Yeah, and then they're only like 25 minutes each, so.
Yeah. All right, well, I guess you
But emotionally, I might not be able to do it, but we'll see.
Well, you got to do it for work now, so, I mean, you can't really do anything else, unfortunately.
Right.
Yeah, cool. Maybe we can get those ahead of time, too, actually. We'll try.
I'm sure we can, yeah. Oh, I don't want to say I'm sure, because
no promises.
It took a little bit of work to get the Defenders screener, so I don't want to sound too confident, but yeah. I think we can.
Yes, we've proven ourselves trustworthy, right? You didn't pirate it, so.
I did not share the Defender screeners on too many other websites.
Nice. Okay, so BoJack's coming back. I think it looks good. It looks like, basically the trailer didn't really like, it wasn't like, oh, this is amazing, except for that BoJack himself wasn't in it that much, which is kind of interesting. I'm curious if they continue that through the season, or if that's just sort of like, oh, we did this for the trailer to kind of, you know, get you interested or curious, but he'll actually be in the show. So we'll see. Either way, they have a really deep bench in terms of characters, so I'm sure they'll be fine. Another animated one, the Nick Kroll's Big Mouth. Did you see that trailer?
I did. I saw the, there are like these two little, not quite trailers, but like segments. One of them depicting sort of like the hormone monster talking to a teenage girl and then a different hormone monster talking to the teenage boy.
Yes.
And it was pretty funny. And it was definitely also not for kids.
No, not for kids. There was a lot of swears in it, I think, right?
Right. Also and on screen masturbation.
Yeah.
I mean, under a blanket, but still.
You knew what was going on.
You knew what
I
was
could
going
tell
on.
Anyway. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm just You'd especially see it clever. All. Yeah. Yeah. It also had like the voice of the hormone monstress, as they called her, was Maya Rudolph. And she did a pretty amazing job with that.
Shh, go ahead, baby.
Who, what are you?
I am the hormone monstress.
If you're here to tell me how terrible being a woman is,
hush,
my mom already...
You're on the rise, girl.
Did you notice that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think I didn't know for sure it was her, but it sounded like her. And then I was looking at that, I was like, oh, yeah, it's probably Maya Rudolph.
Yeah, because their cast is good, too. Well, Nick Kroll has a lot of friends in the comedy space. John Mulaney is the co-star. John Mulaney, I think, maybe is the primary star. And then Nick Kroll, who's the co-creator of the actual show,
right,
is his like friend. And I think they're sort of co-stars as the two main teenage boys in this. And then who are some of the other people in it? Do you have that up to hand or
I'm trying to think who else. I mean, yeah, Mulaney,
great audio,
I think was the
great audio content.
Mulaney is the other one.
Us googling things.
All right, that's the sound of me typing in Big Mouth TechCrunch into Google.
Oh, Jason Mantzoukas is in it. Jenny Slate, Fred Armisen, Jordan Peele.
Yeah,
it's pretty stacked.
It's a pretty great cast.
Yeah. Jesse Klein, who I'm not as familiar with, but she was on SNL, apparently, or a writer on SNL. So yeah, like that's good. That's good stuff. Good comedy stuff. And I like Nick Kroll's sense of humor. He used to do that. There was the Wheels High or whatever. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
It was on his Nick Kroll show, and he did like a parody of Degrassi. It was very, very good. I'm not going to try to describe why it was good or anything, because that will not translate well, but go check it out. Wheels Ontario, or it was Canadian, so everybody kept sending it to me from the TechCrunch staff. And they were like, look, look. But it was
appreciated. Right, you're a sort of Canadian punching bag.
Yeah, exactly. But in this case, it was appreciated because it was actually good.
Yeah. And I mean, and so Kroll and Mulaney did this show on Broadway, Oh Hello, which... I will brag. I did get to see last year. And there was a period where like, it was like the only, just thinking about that show was the only thing that could bring me any joy. Cause it was like
really?
The end of 2016, which was, you know, there's just nothing good happening in the world at that point.
But was it only because of relative value, or was it actually just really enjoyable too?
It was really, it's just really funny. And then just like, it's really surreal. And of course now anyone can go onto Netflix and watch the show.
Yeah, I'll have to do that. I haven't actually watched it.
It's great. It's actually great. And it's another one of those things where you try to describe the joke and it either just sounds incredibly unfunny or you sound like a crazy person or both. And so, you just got to go watch it. And there's just like little things about the performance where they're clearly having a really good time and have spent a lot of time playing these really ridiculous old man characters that there's just, it's just so much fun.
All right, I will check it out because I like them both individually. Like I've watched at least a couple John Mulaney comedy specials too on Netflix, and they're great. So that's coming out. That's September 29th, and do check out the teasers if you haven't. It's got kind of like there's a Family Guy sort of thing going on, but better than Family Guy. But Andrew Goldberg is the co-creator. And writer, and he was a writer on some episodes of Family Guy too. And then maybe a little bit of a Rick and Morty feel to it too, which is never a bad thing, at least in my opinion. Anything else on that, on Big Mouth, you want to?
No, I mean, I'm definitely looking forward to it.
Cool. All right. So that's September 29th on Netflix, all episodes for season one. Okay. Anything else from Netflix? I think... That got all my... Oh, there's a Western coming up, but we don't know almost anything about it.
Except that it's Steven Soderbergh.
Yes. It's directed...
And Jeff Bridges.
And, yeah, directed by Steven Soderbergh, and it's got Jeff Bridges starring.
What more do you need?
That's all you really need. It's a 7-part series or mini-series, I guess you'd call it. And here, I'll read the description, and this will sum up all we know about it. Notorious criminal Frank Griffin... And his gang of outlaws, that's Jeff Daniels, by the way. And his gang of outlaws are on a mission of revenge against Roy Good, played by Jack O'Connell, a son-like protege who betrayed the Brotherhood. Uh-oh. While on the run, Roy seeks refuge with hardened widower Alice Fletcher, played by Michelle Dockery, an outcast herself in a worn-down, isolated mining town of La Belle, New Mexico, governed mainly by women. When word reaches La Belle that Griffin is headed their way, the town bands together to defend against the murderous gang in a lawless western frontier. How's that get you? How'd you like my dramatic reading?
That all sounds fine. Honestly, I think just being like Steven Soderbergh and Jeff Bridges, that to me is much more exciting than your... I think the best thing about your dramatic reading was where you surprised yourself. You'd be like, oh... Oh, is that what happens? Sure.
I didn't read it through before. I was reading it.
Like you were learning it as you were reading. And, yes. And I think that was beautiful in a way.
I think, that's called improv, right? Is that? No. So the other interesting thing about this is that the series creator is the writer of Logan, the movie, the feature movie of the Wolverine that people liked a lot.
Because it was great.
Yeah, because it was great. Which I believe I called and you did not believe that was going to be the case.
Oh, that's why you brought that up, huh? That's true.
That's Scott Frank, and he's going to write and direct the first episode too. So first episode should be good, and then we'll see after that.
Wait, so Scott Frank is writing and directing the first episode, Soderbergh is directing later episodes?
Oh, I guess Soderbergh is like Maybe he's just like a producer. They just call it Steven Soderbergh's epic Western.
Yeah, so. That's one of the things about, I mean, I think this is true with movies too, but especially with TV shows, a lot of times there'll be like these big names attached and then you won't really know exactly the extent of their involvement, because that can mean that they're involved in every day in the writer's room and shooting every episode. Or, I mean, you know, you think about when House of Cards was first announced, everyone was calling it David Fincher's House of Cards.
Right.
He directed, you know, the first two episodes.
Yeah, it could totally just, and like it could be even less than that, right? It could be like Steven Soderbergh presents, you know, when they do that thing. It'd be just absolutely nothing except that they agreed to put their name on it. Or
right, and they pay him a little money and they read the scripts and they're like, this is great.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I assume I've never, you know, been that kind of producer on a television show, so I can't.
Oh,
can't
no, you don't have any high level producer credit.
That's right. Where they just are like, we just really want your name on this.
Get me high. Yeah. So that's November 22nd. That one's a little bit further out, but there's some cool screens and stills from that, and we'll again include a link in the show notes if I remember, which there's no promises that I will, but I'll try.
We'll see what happens.
One more thing before we move on from Netflix, just to say very quickly, like the Death Note kind of reviews are out. I have relatively little interest in checking that out. I wasn't a fan of the series or anything, but the reviews I saw were all bad. So,
Right. Which, I mean, it's kind of a bummer just because, I mean, I don't think that many people were excited about it, but it's directed by Adam Wingard, who made he made The Guest, which was amazing, and then made this Blair Witch movie, which no one seemed to like. Then he made this, which no one seemed to like, and then his next movie is going to be Godzilla versus Kong, which I really, really, really want to be good.
Yes.
And so the fact that his track record has sort of been not great for the last couple of films, especially once he's sort of given these bigger budgets, makes me a little nervous.
Yeah, that does not bode well. And it's not like he had any, like Willem Dafoe is in it. There's some good people in it. But
right.
Oh, well.
Willem Dafoe as like the death god.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I probably won't check that out in the end.
No, I probably the same.
Yeah, but if you want to write in and tell us what you thought of it, maybe we'll share your thoughts instead. Okay. Anything else news wise that we wanted to cover?
I think the one thing we wanted to touch on also was this lawsuit against Ethan and Hilla Klein.
Right. What are they called again?
It's this channel called, it's spelled H3H3. I assume it's probably pronounced he, but I don't actually know if that's true. This is the thing. When you have people who are primarily writers and then they're transitioning to doing video and audio, like there's a lot of stuff we write down that we have no idea how to pronounce.
Yeah.
I've definitely recorded episodes of Crunch Report where, you know, we recap the day's news and I'll be frantically messaging the writers being like, how do I pronounce this? And they'll be like, I have no idea.
Yeah.
But
we have very little idea how anything is pronounced.
I generally try not to speak aloud.
Yeah.
Except, you know, when being paid to do so for, you know, some reason. But they've got this popular channel. Let's assume that it's pronounced he, and people will tell us when we're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But they were sued by this guy, Matt Hoseinzadeh, or he's known as Matt Haas. Yep. And basically he'd made this video that combines, I guess that's his thing, is like combining like parkour and like being like a pickup artist, which is
the Haas guy?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean this is like a lot of, once you get into like these like internet subcultures, they're very hard to explain.
You're like, here's genre is, and it's just like the stupidest, weirdest, most
right.
obscure thing.
You know, the video that I watched, I'm going to say, was not great. And so they did a response video where they basically just like included clips of his video, and they're just like, then clips of them being like, this is really stupid. And
that seems fair. So, seems fair to me.
Right. And so then he sued them. I think basically he tried to get them to take the video down. You know, under like DMCA, then sued them for copyright infringement, basically saying that you can't sue somebody for saying mean things about you. Or actually, he tried to do that later on too. But most of the time, you know, like you've got a stronger legal argument by saying, look, you're using my copyrighted content, so that's what you've done that's illegal. And so that lawsuit got resolved. The judge issued a summary judgment, and basically, as I understand it, threw out the lawsuit saying that, yeah, obviously this is fair use because you've even though they used almost, I think, like the majority of his video gets used in their video, but because it's not just, hey, here's the video, but it's that, you know, that essentially, I think the sort of key concept is sort of transform, you know, is it transformative?
Right.
And so they've made something new from what he's done, and it wouldn't just be like a substitute for his video. And I think one of the reasons why people are interested in this, even if they're not necessarily fans of this couple, is because there's this whole genre of video on YouTube, which is the response video, where you, I mean, essentially they're doing what we're doing, but like with actual video clips and production, you know, like,
weird.
And so like,
why would they not just want to describe it in detail?
Isn't that just so much better when you're like, I can't describe it. You just have to watch it, man. instead of that, you have the thing, you know, playing at the same time. And so the judge basically said in this case that it was fair use, that you can defend it. And she did say that some reaction videos are basically just a group viewing session without commentary, is the phrase that she used. And she's saying, I'm not saying that all reacting videos are by definition fair use, but in this case, at least, she said that they are. So it has that sort of broader implication. It's also just like this, like, kind of strange case. And like, I mean, it's actually, if you're a reporter, you get used to reading these sort of like, you know, court decisions. And this one is actually a pretty fun one because there's like a whole thing where, like, to demonstrate the fact that this video is criticism and not just reposting this guy's original video, the judge just is basically like summarizing every time they diss this guy in the video. And that's like, you know, a page of this court document. That's nice too. But the main point is reaction videos, I think it's opening up the creating a little bit more legal clarity around that.
Yeah, and that is, as you mentioned, like, it's like a huge genre on YouTube, right? So I mean, I think this will embolden a lot of people. Maybe it'll make the space even more kind of like crowded and annoying, but in general it seems like it's a good thing. Like in a very broad sense, like I kind of agree with the ruling based on my very, very surface level understanding of what's gone on. And I think people should be fair or free to call idiots doing parkour and trying to pick people up idiots. Like that seems a very reasonable expectation to have.
Right. And then to quote and to, you know, include clips of the idiocy, essentially.
To prove that their opinion is correct. Yeah. Yeah, we do that. We do that, right? That's the argument, right? Is that we can do that.
Essentially.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. Right.
All right. Well, good job. And then we dove into YouTube. So we're now officially YouTube experts, I think, is how that works.
I think that's fair.
Yeah.
unless we are mispronouncing the channel name.
Well, at the very least, I can put YouTube in the associated tags with this podcast.
That's right. Good. Good.
Okay, so let's. Do you want to cap the news there? I think that's basically.
I think that's it. Yeah. I think we hit it all. And I mean, I think it feels like there was this sort of barrage of content announcements a couple weeks ago. Around, I think, coming right after the Disney announcement, and this week it's been a little slower. But clearly, we still found stuff to blab about.
Oh, there's still a lot, and there's stuff we didn't even talk about, which I'm not going to bring up at all. You can figure it out. You're smart.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah. So let's then move on to talking about the content for this week that we actually checked out and evaluated, and that is the second half of The Defenders. So we had access to the screeners, but then the last four episodes, nobody had access to until they were available. Me and Anthony have both watched those, correct?
Yes, that is correct. And do we want to, I mean, given that we're talking about the second half, do you just want to blanket say that we're going to talk about spoilers?
Yeah, let's do that. That way, you know, we can save everybody. Well, let's give a quick verdict first if people don't want to hear spoilers but want to know if they want to waste their time or not. So thoughts about the series as a whole?
I would say that I enjoyed it but didn't love it. And I think my reaction in some ways, I think, was similar to my feelings about the first season of Daredevil, which I thought was really strong as it was going, and I think probably that's still probably my favorite season of the Marvel Netflix shows that I've seen. But then I thought the final episode wasn't so much bad as it just didn't quite live up to everything it had gone before, and like there'd been a lot of build up, and I don't think that it necessarily matched, lived up to all that buildup. I think similarly, the final episode of The Defenders is fine. It's not terrible, but I didn't love it the way I wanted to love it.
Okay. And I'll say I enjoyed it throughout pretty thoroughly. And I've seen criticism. I've heard from you, and I've seen criticism, similar criticism, like online. But I thought it was good, and I would recommend it heartily to listeners. So, we can get into the actual debate when we get into spoiler territory. But let's cut it there, and then say from here on out, spoilers are fair game. So if you haven't watched it and you want to watch it, turn this off. Or if you just hate yourself, go ahead and keep listening. And we'll get into Spoiler Town. All right.
Here we are in Spoiler Town.
Wow, it's so vast here and green and beautiful. It's a different world.
So, okay, the first thing I want to talk about was, didn't you think in the finale when they are like surrounded by like the dragon skeleton that it was the most, or even just that whole set, like the cave was like the most boring, uninteresting set, and there's like these bones. And they're like definitely like of something big, but they're like, oh, they're dragon bones. You're like, that is not as interesting.
They did one zoom out where they were like, look, and it looks like the thing on his chest. It's the same.
Yeah, it was not. I feel like because like, you know, it'd been seven episodes of.
They really built up like this.
Don't.
What's behind there is going to be so cool. And I totally thought that it was going to be a door to Kunlun, or like actually Kunlun itself. Because they did say too, like there was a point where like Danny's always like, oh, I'd let Kunlun fall. Ugh. And he's all angsty about it. And there was a point where they said, they told him like, oh, maybe you didn't or something, right? Like,
yeah. And they were essentially like, we're going to bring Kunlun back. Or like their goal is to get back to Kunlun.
Yeah, they'll get back there, and you might be surprised that it's actually still there and it didn't get destroyed or anything like that. So they really teased that up, and then they were like, oh, it's like a sewer.
But exactly.
The structural parts of the sewer are rib cage.
Right. But did you, even in the pullout, did you see a giant dragon skull? You just see like the...
I think maybe you saw the skull. But way up,
look again.
It was like in the middle of a wall, like a cross cut, right? Like there was no chance any of them were going up to the skull part.
Right. Like, and I mean, I think part of it is because obviously in at the same time, we're like watching, I assume most of our listeners are also watching Game of Thrones.
Right.
And you're seeing some pretty awesome like dragon skeletons and some pretty awesome dragons.
Yes. And this was a inert dragon, mostly viewed as white columns, white curved columns.
Yeah. Right. And I guess it was also tied to this, like that, like, again, they'd been like hiding the plan for seven episodes, and so, you know, you think, oh man, this is like, there's going to be this grand, you know, really dramatic. And again, because this is like this plan where all of the defenders to come together to save the city, you think this is going to be like this really big, you know, complex, interesting plan. And instead it turns out to be, yeah, we're going to remove these bones. Right. Parts of New York are going to collapse.
I think there's goo in the bones.
Right. There's goo in the bones that allows them to be reborn.
Yeah.
And then, as a result of removing the bones, which we don't really know exactly how long that process takes or like how that works, but whatever, that parts of New York will collapse.
Because they have their structural underpinning is taken away, basically.
Is dragon bones, apparently.
Yeah, which we all knew anyway.
And again, it's not like aggressively bad. You're just kind of like, oh, okay. I mean, fine, I guess.
I'll admit that it seemed like a bit of a, like, painted themselves into a corner. How do we get out of here? Oh, let's make it a dragon bones under structure. Like, it didn't seem necessarily that well thought out as an endpoint.
Yeah, right. Right, that there's no reason why removing dragon bones destroys parts of New York is clearly just an invention of the writers to increase the stakes in this way that feels very transparent.
Well, but they'd have magic. So that's why you couldn't just like put up scaffolding to replace them as you remove them.
Or just more dirt.
The magic is an important part.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now you get it.
So, like, I think that was a big thing for me.
I just kind of breezed past it. I think that my brain was like, don't think about this too hard. And then the rest of me was like, okay, I agree. And we moved right along.
Well, I think that for me, like, it was, is if they had explained it, you know, in episode one or two, okay, this is their plan. We have to stop them.
Oh, and give you that long, like, to kind of adjust to it.
Or? And you're like, that's fine. But it's a thing where everything has to be this mystery now. And so they couldn't reveal it until the very end. And I just thought the mystery solution was not interesting. If it was just like, hey, we have to stop them. They're going to steal this doohickey and it's going to destroy New York. And you're like, yeah, all right, fine, whatever.
But, well, like, I won't disagree that a lot of that part of it, like the buildup and then also the reveal and also the mechanism for it, which is right, Danny's dumb hand, is all kind of like, it, like, if it was just given to me that and like I wasn't thinking about the rest of the package of the Defenders, I would be like, oh, not worth your time. Like, do not. If it was a worse show in many other regards, I would say no. But I think that the rest of it does enough to keep it up that it's like worth watching, and that it doesn't like feel like a waste in the end. But I agree.
Yeah,
with you.
And I want to be clear, I don't think it was a waste. I'm glad I watched it. I just was a little disappointed by the ending.
Yeah. The Danny part was so stupid. Do you want to talk about that? Like, it was literally, I was like, well, they're not going to do this because that would just be incredibly dumb. And then they did exactly what I thought they were going to
right,
do.
Well, so there's like multiple layers to why this is dumb. So for like the plot, right, is that they realize, they're like, oh, they're not trying to recruit Iron Fist. The hand isn't trying to recruit Iron Fist. They just want his power, his chi, to open this doorway.
See, but that they telegraphed pretty early. So that wasn't right, like a...
Yeah, but then the heroes realize this.
The heroes realize it.
Right. Yes. Like, you know, in episode six, I want to say. And that's sort of... And then that sort of precipitates this sort of crisis because then
there's internal conflict.
Right. We're not going to do what we thought we were going to do, which is try to just stop the hand. The main thing we have to do is just keep Danny the hell away from the hand. Which is a little strange because you're like, isn't that kind of what you were planning to do before anyway? But okay.
Yeah, and you couldn't like, do Danny's, it in perpetuity. If you thought it out to its logical conclusion, it wasn't like, okay, I guess we'll just keep him in a cave somewhere forever or whatever. Because they also had the ethical, like which Stick did not have, like the moral sort of like, oh, well, we can't just kill him. Whereas Stick was like, that's exactly what we should do.
Right. Right. Well, I don't think it even occurred to them to kill him, except for then you know, then Danny's like, no, you're not gonna like keep me here. I need to be in the fight. And I mean, I'd say actually that part was reasonably well done.
But also his like stupidity in like not believing that was actually what they wanted him for. Stupidity and maybe hubris. Like,
yeah,
he was like, no, they want me to join their side, and everyone else was like, no, man, they want you. Like, you're a shovel. You're a glorified shovel.
Right. And then so Danny gets tied up. They then like they go off. Like, you know, some of the characters run off to Jessica and Daredevil run off to like do some detective work, which was actually, that was also pretty fun and interesting.
Yes.
But then Stick, knocks out Luke, who's guarding Danny so that he can kill Danny. And then at that moment, basically, Elektra shows up and kills Stick and, you know, knocks out our heroes and Daredevil and Jessica return just in time. But then they're actually knocked out by Elektra as well. And then she kidnaps Danny. And so then when he wakes up in this cave, he's like, no, I'll never work for you. Or I mean, honestly, I don't remember exactly what he said, but then it you know, leads as these things often do to a fight.
Right.
And so Danny is like fighting her and he activates his iron fist and tries to punch her. And then like his fist goes into the wall and naturally his iron fist opens the wall.
He like punches at her and like, right, she's right in front of the wall and she's like, oh, great. And then just like grabs his fist and puts it into the, it was so stupid. It was actually the stupidest thing possible in terms of him, like even for the way they portrayed Danny, which was like not super bright or with a lot of depth or of intelligence, that was like, come on, man, you knew that was what was gonna happen. Like, don't
don't play this with me, Danny.
Yeah. So that part was a bit, hard take. I just wish they had done it a little trickier. Like, I don't know. I'm trying to think of what would be possible there as like a, it's weird to pay. Like, it never works out to play sort of like a couch quarterback in this situation or whatever, but like they could have come up with something that was better than like he punches and she kind of slightly moves out of the way and it hits the wall immediately behind her.
Right. Exactly. I mean, I think, there must have been some other way to like force him to unwillingly like activate the Iron Fist, and to have it like be like that's something he was forced to do rather than something out of stupidity.
Yeah,
because it's just so stupid.
Yeah, it seems bad even for him, which is saying a lot.
Or like if you could have invented some plot where actually he thought he was trying to even if he was trying to destroy the wall or something, then that at least you'd be like, oh well. That was still like the wrong decision, but at least I understand how you were tricked into this. But here you're just like, no, obviously this is the wrong thing to do.
Yeah, they should have like, it would have been much better if it was like a trick carrot or like somebody was able to manipulate him. Like, I mean, they could have freaking, I know that they had to, they were like, there was a narrative of like Colleen does not turn, but they could have done a way where she like artificially turns or like is controlled by the hand in some way, and then she convinces Danny that it's the proper course of action to do it, right, and then is revealed to have betrayed him or something. Like, I think that would have been better. Anything would have been better.
A lot of different things would have been better.
Yeah but the stick stuff was good. That was perfect. That was like pitch perfect for his character. I'm going to kill Danny. And also, that was another place where it was a little bit stretching credibility that nobody would have suspected him of being capable of that, especially after he's just beheaded someone else, right?
Well, it's specifically that Daredevil, that Matt, wasn't immediately suspicious. Yeah.
He's been suspicious of the whole time. And basically, every single time Stick says something, he says, like, don't listen to the old man. He's just trying to trick you. And then he's like, okay, we're going to leave Danny here with Luke, and I'm going to leave. And like,
right. Originally, he was even going to take Luke with him, and it was just going to be Stick with Danny, in which case Danny would definitely be dead.
Yeah, that's a lot of trust to suddenly generate or to suddenly like sort of materialize in somebody that does not trust Stick at all, right?
Yeah. I mean, I have to say that, I mean, I like Charlie Cox, and I like the Daredevil character, but I wasn't crazy about the way he was treated in this in the series, because I felt like he just, because Elektra was involved, that was like, that was really the only thing that motivated, well, that like first couple of episodes before he knows Elektra is back, he was just motivated by I can't become Daredevil again, I just have to like, you know, right, kick this terrible addiction I have. But then as soon as he sees Elektra, his only real goal is you know, finding Elektra again. And that in a lot of ways that he like fucks a lot of things up, because like there's like a scene where they're, you know, all supposed to work together in this fight scene. And then he's like, oh, Elektra, I have to like talk to you. And then even at the end, you know, everyone is giving these like speeches about how, you know, Matt sacrificed himself to defend the city. But he really didn't. He sacrificed himself because he wanted to try to save Elektra one more time.
Yeah.
But like nothing he did helped save, you know, New York. It was just, you know, he wanted to stick around and talk to Elektra some more. And he knew he was probably going to die, which I like that aspect of it. But they're giving these speeches about how heroic he was. He's like, I don't know that in this series he was actually that heroic or smart.
Yeah. And it's weird because his motivation in past has been pretty, like, it would have been very easy to make it credible that he was like giving up everything for the city, but they didn't arrive at that like through the narrative, right?
And there was like, and Stick, there's the whole exchange where Stick is like, you should definitely be the leader of the defenders.
Yeah.
And instead he's like, I assumed that that meant that at some point he would have to, you know, take the high, like choose between, okay, am I going to like continue my obsession with Elektra, or am I going to like take the high road and like actually like lead the defenders to save the city? And instead, he's just kind of like, all right, you guys can all leave. I'm going to stick around.
Yeah.
For not a very good reason.
Yeah. That was a weird one. I mean, you do get the sense that he has like, his love for her is kind of like pretty believable, right? And his like obsession with her after what happened to her because of him. So you get that. Like, he's a Catholic. He's like, I don't know, he feels a lot of guilt over it, right? Catholic guilt.
Right. That's right. So, I mean, and I think I will say that I think the final scene between Daredevil and Elektra, I think, is really good.
Yes. Like, I thought that whole fight and then the result of it was good. Like, it was just well done and it was believable, and I don't know. I feel like we're only saying bad things about the show when I really did enjoy it, and I thought the pacing and everything else remained excellent throughout, because I remember that was one of the things we talked about in the start.
Yeah, and I have to say, I mean, I thought the pacing was fine throughout. Even I know some people really did not like the fact that they don't really start intersecting until the third episode, and maybe I can see that maybe it really should have been one episode where they were separate and then they kind of all came together, you know, at the very end of the first episode or in the second episode. But I think that what they have works, and like that idea of here are these, like, they're each in their own separate, you know, story, and then they're sort of forced together, and you get to actually see that in a way that you wouldn't in an Avengers movie.
Yeah,
that I liked.
There was some good fight scenes too in the later half.
Yeah,
I wanted to see more of Jessica just throwing people. She did a fair amount of throwing people, but every time she was not, I was like, why isn't she just throwing these people around like she's able to? Or like,
but I really like the idea that Jessica and Luke are like basically these sort of like tanks who can like,
yeah,
that who don't know a lot of don't know any martial arts essentially. Which, I mean, there are even jokes about that. But they can just essentially that what they do is they just, you know, want to like beat the shit out of you as quickly and efficiently as possible. There's nothing like fancy about it, but they just like
walk up to you. Basically.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of this like, yeah, closer to probably like what real fighting is like.
I imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've gotten one fight in third grade and never again.
Yeah. I thought that was good too. And I thought that the, like some of the criticism that I've seen, you know, on Twitter and stuff is that this is like, it's a team up between the good puncher, the great puncher, the special puncher, and the other puncher. And like, that's to some extent that is true, but there was enough to differentiate them, even Jessica and Luke, which is hard because they have a very similar power set that I thought they each kind of fit their own niche, in those fight scenes in a way that worked.
Yeah. And I mean, I think there's that much sharper division between, like, on the one hand, Daredevil and Iron Fist, who are sort of, yeah, these sort of fancy martial artists. And then on the other hand, these sort of street fighters.
Yeah.
Jessica and Luke. And I think that works pretty well. But I will, I mean, not to keep bringing it back to the negative, but I will say, like, I do think, like, some of the mid-season fights, like the first fight where they all come together in episode 3, the big fight in the restaurant in episode 5, I think those are really the best fights of the...
Yeah, the restaurant one is the one I was thinking of. Because the cave one is not as good.
Right, it's fine. But as the climax, again, as the sort of the climax of everything, you're like, oh, that was fine. Like, I mean, because it's just like a lot of it is happening in the dark.
Yeah.
And you can see, it's not that you can't see what's going on, but it's just not very, it's just like sort of in this kind of boring looking dark cave.
Yeah. And there's limited overhead space and that kind of limits it too. And they didn't really give you a super satisfying like face off with the main.
Yeah, exactly. That was like, I wanted to see, especially that the Japanese guy whose name I can't remember. He, you know, he was like built up as this like really terrifying guy, and you didn't get to see him really do anything.
Yeah, because he was there. Like, his whole thing was like, oh, he's a hunter, and then he's also like the lone wolf, right? Like, he does it all himself. He doesn't have a big, huge army like most of the other ones do. And then that doesn't pay off. You're like, yeah, but you're not any better than anybody else at fighting. So like, why? Why don't you not have an army? So that was kind of an issue.
In all the fights, he's just another person that they're fighting, and he clearly is good, but like,
yeah,
I wanted to see him like beat the shit out of one of the defenders.
Yeah, I mean, Gao is a much better fighter than him because she has crazy chi powers or whatever, where she can like punch from a distance and have it have like a tremendous area impact or whatever. And then like, obviously Elektra is quite good and remains quite good throughout. What did you think about the big twist? I didn't see it coming at all.
I did not. So we're talking about Sigourney Weaver being Alexandra being killed in the end of the sixth episode.
Yeah.
And yeah, I was like, what? Holy shit.
Yeah.
That I definitely was like, what? Oh my God.
That was great. That was a great example of using not only like narrative expectation, but using like,
right.
You know, not breaking the fourth wall, but using your built-in expectation of this is a very, very high profile actress, like the highest profile member of this cast. So I'm not expecting her to die prior to the like conclusion, and definitely not in this manner, which was pretty much, you know, it was unceremonious. It was just like, okay, Elektra killed her from behind without her knowing in the middle of a speech. It was, you know, like, wow, she's gone. So that was great. I think that was one of the strongest parts of this show in terms of narrative effect. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, it's also funny to think about in the context of, I mean, that Sigourney Weaver, you know, first became famous through Alien, which I think is also a movie where, you know, when you watch it, you don't necessarily, you know, you'd probably say like Tom Selleck was like the biggest actor. I mean, there weren't super big actors, but like you wouldn't have said that Sigourney Weaver was the star of that movie. You only realize it when everyone else has been killed off.
Mm-hmm, right.
And I think there's something similar where like actually in this case, she has become the big star who you kill off to sort of like up the stakes in some way.
Yeah. Yeah. For so sure. Sort of like I didn't realize that, but that is totally like a nice mirror. I wonder if that was like a actual intentional homage.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it might be because, I mean, that episode is also the, I mean, and so like, I assume that part of the reason she got involved was because of Drew Goddard, who, was the original showrunner of Daredevil very briefly. And, but before that, and wrote the episode that she died in, and so he was an executive producer on The Defenders. But before all of that, he co-wrote and directed, Cabin in the Woods, which, spoiler for Cabin in the Woods, but also involves a Sigourney Weaver appearance that very much plays on sort of her history and what you know about her. So I wouldn't be surprised if at least that was a little bit in the back of her of their minds.
Huh. Cool. Yeah. So if that was like the strongest point for me. And then I, you know, to our earlier comments and your criticism and my criticism, it kind of went a bit downhill from there, but. I mean, I still think like definitely net positive. Like, even though I'm making those criticisms now, like they weren't things that were actively thinking about while I was watching them. They weren't taking me out of the story. Was it like a reflective, like 2020 hindsight is 2020 thing for you? Or was it like while you're watching it, you're like, come on.
It wasn't, none of this stuff I think really bothered me in the sense that I was like unhappy watching it more than when it was over. I was kind of like, oh, that's it.
Mm, yeah.
That was, you know, I wanted to, yeah, feel a bit more in those final moments, I suppose. So it wasn't, I don't think that anything like really took me out of it. And definitely like when Alexandra gets killed, I was like, holy shit. And then, because you see like there's like she like gives this triumphant speech and you just see this like blade coming out of her chest, and like for the first few seconds you're just like, who, how, what, I don't, and then like you see Elektra and then you're still just like shocked, and I just like that was a great twist. The downside of it was that I think
it's hard to top
and I think that the hand as an organization is interesting, but I mean, I just think like this is not to say that any of the writing around the hand was necessarily bad or that any of the other actors were not that interesting, but like I think Sigourney Weaver is just sort of in a class of her own in that part of the show. And so there's also, it's like this thing where, oh wow, that was like this really ballsy script move, but then, oh, like I really liked having this, you know, this group led by that. She, like any scene that Sigourney Weaver was in, it's just better.
Yes, she was the strongest performer in the show, so it's hard to have her taken off the list. And I don't think Elektra is that good as like overall. I think I don't think she's bad either, but she wasn't a strong enough performer. I'm sorry, I don't know who actually played her. I should look this up too, but I don't know if she was a strong enough performer to kind of fill that role and what was required of it, right?
Yeah, and I mean, I because I was wondering about this too, in the sense that I did not see the actress, by the way,
Elodie Young.
Is that I didn't see Daredevil season two, so I didn't have that connection with the character.
That's what I feel like when your criticism about the Daredevil stuff.
Fine. I understand that. Yeah, it's sort of maybe I didn't.
They established that pretty well. They established the connection between them.
Right. It's not that I didn't believe it. It's just that it didn't come off as, you know, particularly that it seemed like part of the show was trying to position him as, you know, the lead defender.
Right.
And I think that because he was like, and that, you know, people would actually have conversations with him where they said, hey, like, your obsession with this person is really like doing damage to our cause.
Yeah.
And so to me, like, that was clearly setting up, you know, that part of his arc is like his story is getting over that, and that the heroic thing to do would be to let that go in some way. And he did the opposite thing. Right. So that made it sort of unsatisfying to me.
It was a selfish move ultimately, right?
Yeah.
It was not really positioned as such, which is a missed opportunity, right? Like, if they wanted it to be that, that's interesting too. But they should have emphasized, like, no, he took this way out, right? Instead of bringing it up.
Yeah. But instead of, you just get all these speeches about how much he loved New York and how heroic he was. And you're like, that's sort of true from like other stuff, but like in terms of like what we've seen here, like not so much. But I think the fundamental problem is I found Elektra interesting, but I wasn't like super invested in her. And so much of the last episode in particular is really about that relationship. And so without that, I felt like it didn't quite work for me. And I mean, it sounds like in your case that it wasn't totally a slam dunk for you too.
No, it wasn't. It definitely could have been better. There was a bit of a, it was a bit lumpy in terms of arc, right? Like, I would say it achieved its highest heights, you know, in the episode where Alexander dies, and then sort of peters off after that, and never descends into the depths of like awfulness or anything. But that was where it was strongest, and then
and then
it suffers, and part of it was part of it was like not making good use of the rest of the hand too, because they were all pretty strong. I always, even on Iron Fist, which I know you didn't watch, like Bakudo is kind of like whatever. Spoilers for that too. But if you've gone this far, you should have seen all the other series anyway. But
or like, you should accept that you're going to be spoiled for them.
Yeah. But in that one, they have a surprising, similar sort of surprising twist where Bakudo seems like a good character and then comes out as like, the worst character, like the villain of the piece. And it works pretty well. I think it's a bit more telegraphed, but I never found him a super strong actor to begin with. And then I think in this one, that's also true. But like, Gao could have been much better used. Gao has been terrific in all of the preceding series, and I feel like she was a bit wasted here. Especially, I mean, she kind of stayed true to character. Like, she's not one to draw undue attention to herself. Like, she'll do what she needs to do to achieve her ends, but typically, like, that doesn't involve grabbing the top spot. So I think that was kind of interesting, and it looks like we'll see her again. Like, they really left it kind of open,
right?
Again. So I'm excited about that because I think she's consistently been strong. But yeah, I would have liked to see more of the. I just think that in general across the whole series they didn't do enough with the other fingers of the hand.
Yeah, because I remember that there was like a point where, I mean, it seems dumb to say that. I think maybe when I mentioned this in the last episode too, is like, there's that point where they're like, oh yeah, we're called the hand and there are five of us. There are five fingers of the hand. I was like, oh my God, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
I never thought of that. That's so good. And I think individually, each of them, I think is quite good. I mean, I think I can't remember his name, the Japanese hand guy, and Bakudo and Madame Gao are all good. And then Sawande is fine too.
Oh yeah, that's true. And he was kind of wasted too, because he was probably one of the more interesting like the actor was one of the stronger ones, and then they
yeah,
and he had a lot of good scenes, and the use of him was strong, but it would have been good to see him. Like, he was another one where Stick says something very threatening about him, or like, you know, he's a very dangerous person, and you don't really get to see that. Like, he has his army. That was unsatisfying too, because Luke Cage just shows up and he's like, "Oh, I got this guy." You're like, "Wait a minute, how?"
Hey, there's like a fair amount of stuff that happens off screen in a way that's sort of confusing. Like, there's that. There's also in the final episode this weird moment where the police are about to stop them from leaving the building right before it blows up, and then like Luke Cage is like, "I can't let this happen." And you think, oh, there's going to be like a fight between the police, or he's going to talk. I don't know what's going to happen. Right. And then you just cut to the outside and you see the building blow up and they're just like standing outside. And you're like, what? What happened? I don't understand. Like, what was – I mean, if you – and like, why even – if you didn't want to show him fighting those cops, that's fine. Just like show them leaving the building. It was just very kind of strange what they chose to include and not include in those – some of those moments.
Yeah. And maybe it was just that it was full already, right? Like, there's a lot they had to do. So – But
it's funny, as we're talking, it does make me wonder if, I mean, I think this would have been a very dramatically different show, but like, that I wonder if like maybe I would have liked the version more that didn't include Elektra and it was just about the hand and fighting the defenders.
Yeah.
And you got to see each of the members, because definitely, especially in those final two episodes, I think it really becomes all about Elektra in this way that, again, didn't work so much for me.
Yeah, and in that way, it's almost more just a straight sequel to the most recent season of Daredevil than it is this culminating series of all of the shows. Like, I would say it owes less to any of the other shows than it does to that.
Right.
It, in the same way that, like, sort of Captain America Civil War is, like, almost like another Avengers installment. To bridge the main, more than it is like a sequel to the last Captain America. I think that's definitely the case. And I think even the after credit scene, right, leads right to, and here's what happens next with Daredevil. Like, it seems like it's Daredevil's story more than anybody else's.
Wait, was there an after credit scene?
Oh, you didn't see it?
Wait, there's not, because no, there's like a scene where you see him in the, like he survived, but that's before the credits.
Oh, is that before the credits? I thought I had to fast forward through the credits.
No. The last episode is very interestingly structured because like all of the action sort of happens by like 2/3 of the way through. And then the last part is just like everyone being sad about and moving on with their lives. And so that kind of keeps going. And then the very last scene is, I'm pretty sure it before credits is Matt Murdock in this, being taken care of by this nun.
Huh. Yeah, okay. I wasn't sure when it happened, but I remember, anyway, that...
90% sure that it was before the credits.
I believe you. But yeah, I did see that as kind of like, oh yeah, okay, this is more of that. Like, it's more an interim Daredevil interlude, I guess.
Right, and I guess that's, again, not to keep harping on sort of the comparison to the Avengers, but I think... And again, in some ways, this is more interesting than the Avengers because it has time to explore these different plots and give the characters room to breathe and bring in some of the side characters. But I think one of the things the Avengers did do well is that, that it brings in this plot from the first Thor movie, where it's about Thor and his brother Loki. But you don't have to have seen Thor to care about it. And even if you don't, even if you're just like, oh, it's just Tom Hiddleston being this charming villain, it's still a really satisfying movie. And I think that for the ending of the Defenders to work, it felt like you had to be a little bit more caught up and a little bit more invested in Elektra.
I always had recommended that before, right? That you catch up and everything. Like, do you change your recommendation now, having seen the whole thing? Because you had said like, you
can, I mean, it's hard to say because I don't know how much of that is. I mean, probably it couldn't hurt to watch the second season of Daredevil because it does seem like. That a lot of that emotional stuff seems to draw on their relationship. But it's also, in some ways, this Elektra is a new character too, right? That it's not just about their relationship before, because she's sort of created, without, that it's part of the the point of the series is figuring out how much of her is like a new person versus this old person.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's hard to say for sure how much of it is just, oh, I haven't seen Daredevil season two, and how much of it is like, oh, well, there was some clumsy writing, especially towards the end there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair.
Probably a little bit of both.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was, I mean, it was obviously a challenge to do that kind of thing, but it's not like an unheard of challenge, right? Like the Marvel movies have had to deal with exactly the same kind of narrative difficulties than bringing together a bunch of disparate characters who each have their own individual series, right? So you can't chalk it all up to that too. So it definitely fell down in the writing department a bit, I think, towards the end.
Yeah. So I guess maybe the last thing I wanted to talk about was, how did you feel about that final shot of Matt Murdock surviving?
Well, I mean, it was not at all surprising.
Like, right.
I don't know if they thought that it was going to be, or if it maybe is to people who are not like frequent comics readers, but because like as a person who reads a lot of comics, I never expect anyone to be dead, basically.
Right, and especially when you know that there's going to be a Daredevil season three, it's like you're not going to like.
Yeah, I think a lot of people saw that coming. I think the circumstances of it were kind of interesting. Like, where did he work? Did he wake up in a monastery or a nunnery or something?
Yeah, I mean, there's a nun caring for him, which I think one of the things it's supposed to sort of recall is this, you know, classic storyline, Born Again.
Right.
But like, I was really confused by that because like the setup for Born Again is so different from where Daredevil is at this current point in the series. So like, were they saying, oh, we're going to do Born Again in season three? I think that's how some people chose to interpret that. But it seems weird because it doesn't really seem like that's where they're at with the series. Partly because like the whole thing.
But they've kind of been out all over the place with the series anyway.
Yeah, right? But it's just, I mean, I guess they could, but it was just sort of strange. And then even if that's what they were trying to communicate, it felt kind of strange to me because I was like, well, if you don't recognize this shot as resembling these like comics panels, this scene doesn't really mean the same thing. It just means, oh, he's alive.
Right.
Which you're like, yeah, I mean, I kind of figured that out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I guess it's a tough thing, but like there was this feeling of like, well, if he's alive, why did I just spend 15 minutes listening to speeches about how he's dead and how sad it is?
Right. Yeah, that's true, because it takes away any of the narrative purpose that had, I guess. Like, yeah, it takes the wind out of the sails of it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting to compare it also to like Batman versus Superman, which is a bad movie, a very bad movie, and The Defenders is much better than Batman versus Superman.
Yeah.
But I think, man, we're just, I mean, I think at this point we can spoil Batman versus Superman, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So like, you know, so Superman dies at the end of that, and like everyone knows he's going to come back, and like it's this weird balance where, you know, they're not showing him in the trailers to Justice League. He doesn't come back at the end of Batman versus Superman. All you get is this little shot of the dirt above his grave beginning to sort of like vibrate,
right,
in this way. And so it's like this way of winking of like, hey, you know, and we know that he's coming back, but we're not going to like rub it in your face now and just take away any sort of like the sadness that we wanted you to feel. I mean, part of it is also like, hey, if you're not going to kill somebody, maybe just don't waste your time killing them in this way. But like, if you're going to do it, like at least commit to it for, in my opinion, at least commit to it for like the duration of the episode or the movie. And then if you want to bring them back, you know, a movie later or whatever, fine. But don't have a 20, you know, 15, 20 minute segment about everyone being sad that Matt Murdock is dead and then be like, surprise, he's alive. See you season two.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And they didn't do anything like, it was just that, like you said earlier, like it wasn't, if they had added a little bit more like context around like why or where is he alive or like anything like that, like
right,
there's a time jump or, you know, something
right,
like that,
surprise,
that was like a noteworthy, yeah, surprising
first,
twist.
Right. Right, versus being like, better. "Hey, he's alive." Did you didn't see that coming? Did you? You're like, "Yeah, no, everyone knew he was alive."
It's, yeah, we all knew that.
It's fine.
Yeah, it's too bad. Anyways, still, all this stuff aside, like we only talked about bad stuff.
I still recommend it. I still think people should watch it, and I liked it. That sounds
No, I liked it a lot, and I think like I would say part of it. I think what we talk about. I mean, partly because I think it's always more fun to talk about, like,
that's
to
just sort
of do the nitpicky stuff. Yeah. And I think that's just part of how these conversations work. I think part of it was also though that, like, aside from the twist, which I think was amazing. I think the twist is really, really well done. Did not see it coming. That totally, like, got me excited about the show.
Yeah.
Aside
if you listen to this and ignore the spoiler warning, and you that was ruined for you, I'm very sad.
Right, but you're an idiot for ignoring the spoiler warning. But I would say that aside from that, everything that was good was also like was like a continuation of the stuff that was good in the first half of this of the season, and like then like I think these other problems started to crop up, and so that was kind of partly why I wanted to focus on those versus like yes, like the all, you know, the characterization is still good, the action is still well done, and all of that.
Yeah, and I hope that that's not like a, something that starts to become a problem across series like this. Like the Marvel series on Netflix have a certain invincibility almost. Like they're going to do well pretty much regardless because of a built-in audience and because of the value of the franchise and the IP and everything. So you have to worry like maybe that's why things taper off is like there's the sense of like, well, it's going to do all right regardless. Let's just wrap it up. Which would be awful. I really hope that doesn't, because I mean, eventually that'll just erode the brand, and then it'll all be garbage and go away. So hopefully they avoid that. But
right, and I mean, there's a couple of different things at play. There's what you're talking about. There's, I think, with the other shows, there's been the issue of maybe 13, like people figuring out how to tell a story with 13 episodes, maybe being a little too long. And I think definitely having 8 for this, I think. Some of that was probably just like production, like that they couldn't get all the actors they wanted for that long. But like, I think it worked. Like it just worked for the story too.
Yeah.
But I do think like there's also something about how, and I mean I know that other people may not agree with me as much on this as I have some of the same problems with like some of the Marvel movies, is like there's once you like move into the sort of comic booky storytelling, it also gets harder to tell. To have satisfying endings because you're always leaving things open for the next thing. And so there's this feeling of you can never do like the big ending that like either is like incredibly tragic or wraps everything up or, you know, whatever, because you've got to immediately be like, oh, and then here's the next thing that's coming up too. And so I think that has also the fact that like the Defenders is, you know, wrapping up this one story, but is also setting up the next seasons of each of these characters probably also, you know, made it harder to make a satisfying ending.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually that's like, though, to its credit, they didn't really do much with the other characters in terms of like, you know, putting much detail effort into their
arc.
That's
true.
And that's good. I think that's good. I think if they had tried to do that, it would have been quite messy at the end.
Right.
I said, and now Luke Cage and here's this guy.
Right. Here's let's introduce, like, in this montage, let's introduce you to the villains of each of the
right. That would have been awkward as heck.
And there was no Punisher. I was super happy that there was no Punisher.
I know. That would have been an easy indulgence for them to do, and they did not do it. So that's good.
Yeah.
Good kudos on your restraint, Netflix, for that.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So final verdict is still go watch the show, it seems like.
Still go watch the show. Not as enthusiastic as I was last week, but still go watch it.
Okay, good. So just to close off here, we've gone pretty long. But does...
each episode gets longer than the one before it. I mean, by episode 4, we'll be doing like day-long episodes.
Yeah, that'll be great. Is there anything, though, that you're excited about watching next or that you want to give a shout-out to for people to check out?
As far as shout outs, I don't have anything. In terms of what's next, I mean, I think my vote would be for The Tick.
Yeah, we should do The Tick. That's coming now, right? Or is it?
It's tomorrow, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, that's a good one to do.
I mean, we've been kind of on superheroes for a while.
Yeah.
But like, at least we're not just doing Netflix.
Yeah, it's Amazon, and it's also a very, very different type of show. So I think that's fair. I think I like. There's also out of nowhere that White Gold show arrived. I haven't heard anything about it, but I'm curious to check that out. That's on Netflix.
Oh, I don't know anything about that one.
It's got the guy from Gossip Girl in it. I forget his name.
Oh, yeah. Ed Westwick. Yeah, I love that guy. Chuck Bass.
Yes, Chuck Bass. Yeah. So I think I might try to watch that. And then, also Ozark. And people keep, I've just heard this, like, it's like been a slow build, but everybody just keeps saying, Ozark is great. Watch Ozark.
Yeah. So. And now there are all these like jokes about it in the company Slack.
Yeah, exactly. We got to get up. We got to be able to understand.
Right. We're the original content guys. We can't like be left behind here.
I know. Slacking on that. All right. Anyways, that's going to do it. So come back next week. We'll have thoughts on The Tick and maybe some of these other ones, depending on what we can fit. But and we'll definitely have news and perhaps some interviews. Those are still in the works. So
knock on wood.
Keep your ears peeled, I guess. All right. Thanks, Anthony. Great talking with you as always.
Yeah. Thanks, Daryl. And we'll see you guys next week.